In our last sermon for Mark 4 a few weeks ago, we examined the story of Jesus stilling the wind and the waves by the word of his power, bringing calm from chaos. It was a remarkable display of authority, leading the disciples to ask in fear and awe, "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" And this event challenged them to deepen their understanding of the identity of Jesus as he did things the Old Testament said that only God could do. We must now recall why they were on the sea. Jesus had said back in chapter 4, verse 35, "Let us cross over to the other side." This meant moving from Jewish to non-Jewish Gentile territory for the first time in the Gospel of Mark. Now, back in chapter 3, we saw people from Gentile areas coming to see Jesus. Now, in a sense, he is reciprocating by going among them. His visit is brief, but Mark gives more space to this event than to any other outside of the Passion of Christ. It is clearly significant to the flow of his gospel, and we'll seek to unpack some of that significance this morning. We're going to do so simply by moving through the story and offering some concluding reflections that we can learn from it. We begin with verse 1. "Then they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gadarenes." So the raging sea has not been able to thwart the mission of Jesus. The boat reaches the other side of the Sea of Galilee safely. Now, there's some debate about exactly where that location was that they landed. And your translations may vary, some saying the Gadarenes, the Gerasenes, or the Gergesenes. The important thing is that it was Gentile territory, and Jesus gets quite a welcome. Verse 2, "And when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit." So after that desperate journey, after that safe arrival, Jesus steps out of the boat, and immediately, who is it that meets him? Well, it's a man with an unclean spirit. What a welcoming party that is to the eastern shore. Now, of course, that's not the first time this kind of thing has happened. When Jesus inaugurated his ministry in Jewish territory, he encountered a man with an unclean spirit. That episode, recorded in chapter 1, took place at the very heart of Jewish religious life outside of Jerusalem, that is, in the local synagogue. And the narrative in chapter 5 provides a parallel to this earlier story as Jesus now inaugurates his ministry in Gentile territory. Wherever Jesus goes, he is confronted by uncleanness and the demonic. Now, we know that he cast out the unclean spirit from the man in the synagogue. So now we wonder, what will he do here? Before Mark gives us an answer to that question, he provides a lengthy description of this man in verses 2 through 5. This is not like the synagogue goer that Jesus met in chapter 1. Picking back up in verse 2, "There met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with chains. The chains had been pulled apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, neither could anyone tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones." Now let's think back with the different aspects of this description, and I encourage you to sort of try to picture them in your mind. Get a picture of who this man was, who he was known to be in this region. First of all, he was demon-possessed. That's what it means to have an unclean spirit. He was demon-possessed. He was basically cut off from society. He lived primarily among the tombs. Think of someone who lives in a graveyard. And he also roamed about in the mountains, alone, apart from others. But he was a terror to others. They feared him. They had at various times bound him with chains. But he had amazing strength. and he would break the chains. No one, nothing could constrain him or control him. And then we see that he's also a terror to himself, because day and night he is crying out and he's cutting himself. And from verse 15, we deduce that he's either barely clothed, perhaps in rags, or even naked. You see, these demons have possessed him, and they have reduced him to uncontrollable insanity. They are leading him on a path to self-destruction, for that is what demons do. They distort and destroy the image of God in man. Among the tombs, this man is a picture of uncleanness, death, and desperate terror. You wouldn't want to meet him, I'm sure. But he meets Jesus. Verse 6, when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him. And he cried out with a loud voice and said, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me." For he, that is Jesus, said to him, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." So the demon-possessed man sees Jesus from afar. He runs to him. He falls down before him. Now, the New King James translation here, "worshipped him," is, I believe, a bit misleading. The Greek verb means to kneel or to prostrate oneself before another. It can, in some contexts, be used to form a worship, but it can also be used simply to indicate recognition of another's superior position. And many of the other English translations reflect this meaning. The ESV says that he fell down before him. The NSB bowed down before him. NIV fell on his knees in front of him. I don't think we're to picture this demoniac actually worshiping Jesus as God, but he does recognize Jesus' unique position of authority over him. That is, the demon within the man recognizes the authority of Jesus, and he addresses him, "Jesus, Son of the Most High God." Now, that phrase, "Most High God," was a title that was used by God among Gentiles in the Old Testament. They did not know God by the covenant name of Yahweh, but they could refer to the Most High God. And so it's a natural sort of term to be used in this Gentile territory. And what we see once again is that while the disciples are trying to wrestle with the identity of Jesus, who can this be that does these great things? The demons know exactly who he is. In fact, this demon says almost exactly what the demon in the synagogue back in chapter 1 said to Jesus, "What have I to do with you?" Recognizing Jesus for who he is, the demon realizes he's on opposite sides of the spiritual fence from Jesus. And the next thing he says is really quite ironic. Remember, this is a demon speaking to Jesus. And he says, "I implore you by God that you do not torment me." Now, what irony. This demon has just identified Jesus as the Son of the Most High God, and this demon seeks to invoke the name of God against Jesus. Furthermore, this unclean spirit, who is a tormenting man, pleads with Jesus not to torment him. Now, we know that Jesus had already spoken to him. He had said to him, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." So the picture we have here is of Jesus taking the initiative. Jesus sees him. He calls for the unclean spirit to come out. And the demon, through the man, pleads in response to what Jesus says. But Jesus remains in control of the situation. Verse 9, then he asked him, "What is your name?" And he answered, saying, "My name is Legion, for we are many." So Jesus speaks to him authoritatively. He asked the demon's name, and the demon submissively replies. But the reply is somewhat surprising, for the name indicates that a multitude of demons inhabits this man. People in Palestine knew what a legion was. It was a unit of Roman occupation force. A legion was a military unit numbering 6,000 soldiers. So we have here this odd mixture of singular and plural pronouns. "My name is Legion, for we are many." Jesus wasn't confronting merely a single demon, as he had before. He is confronting a veritable army of demons. A veritable army of demons who have taken up residence in this one poor man. Speaking through the possessed man, the legion of demons now makes a request of Jesus. Also, he begged him earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. Note that there's no question here that Jesus has control. The demons know that he's going to cast them out of the man. They expect that. So they don't ask that he not do that. Rather, they ask that they not be cast out of the region. Now, we're not told why. Perhaps they felt they had some sense of ascendancy in this Gentile territory. We are immediately reminded of that territory, beginning at verse 11. We read, "Now a large herd of swine was feeding near the mountains. So all the demons begged him, saying, 'Send us to the swine that we may enter them.' And at once Jesus gave them permission. Then the unclean spirits went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000, and the herd ran violently down the steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea." Now, children, I have a question for you. Do you know what swine are? What's another word for the animal called swine? You know? Pigs, right. Swine are pigs. And at this time, the Jewish people were not allowed to eat the meat of pigs. No ham, no pork, no bacon. I'm so glad that was a temporary law. This was an aspect of their dietary laws that we read about in our Old Testament lesson in Leviticus. And these laws were not given because there was something wrong with pigs or with pig meat. They were not given for health reasons. They were given as one of the ways in which Israel was to be distinguished from the nations round about. And of course, you know that the Lord ultimately sent Peter that vision of the sheep with the many unclean animals in it, telling him he could eat, because that time has passed away. So we no longer live under those dietary laws of the Old Testament. But those laws were in place in Jesus' day, and so you would never find a herd of pigs in Jewish territory. But Jesus is among Gentiles, non-Jews, who didn't worship the true God. They didn't live by God's law that had been given to Israel. And the demons beg Jesus to send them into the pigs, and Jesus authoritatively grants them this permission. They leave the man, enter the pigs, which then run down a steep place into the sea and are drowned. It's a bit bizarre, isn't it? I had somebody stop by the church this week. He was doing our pest control, and he asked what I was preaching on. I told him about this story. He'd never heard it before. Thought it was pretty wild. So look it up in the Gospel of Mark. It's there. But what's it all about? We can't probably get all of our questions answered, but let's note a few things. First of all, the large number of pigs, there were about 2,000, corroborates the large number of demons that had been in this man. That their name was Legion was no false boast, because they could fill 2,000 pigs. And the demons succeeded in doing so. And doing to the pigs what they had been intent on doing to man, that is, they destroyed them. Satan is a murderer from the beginning. Satan is pro-death. Satan longs to destroy God's creation. And given much that's in our current news cycle, I should remind you that he especially loves to destroy God's image bearers. And the pro-abortion movement in our country is demonic. I just say, if you've seen some of the protests recently, I mean, it's just becoming more and more obvious. People are not holding back. It's really not that hard to see through. But what you need to remember is that, like this man that Jesus encountered, what these people need are Jesus. We want to pass laws. We want to protect the unborn. But what's going to change people with that demonic mindset? They need deliverance through Jesus. We also see in the story that the sea that could not keep Jesus from reaching this place is now the instrument he uses to vanquish the demons. Like Pharaoh's army of old, they are drowned in the sea. Now, we're not told what happened to the demons. As spirit beings, I don't suspect that they themselves were destroyed, that they would have to find some other hosts other than the pigs. The most important thing, of course, is they did not return to that man who had been delivered by Jesus, and they were symbolically defeated. They were genuinely defeated by the one stronger than themselves. Now, where you have sheep, you have shepherds. And where you have swine, you have swineherds caring for them. And we read now of these witnesses to what happened, starting at verse 14. So those who fed the swine fled, and they told it in the city and in the country. And they went out to see what it was that had happened. Then they came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who saw it told how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. Then they began to plead with him to depart from their region. Not surprisingly, word spread pretty quickly about what had happened, and people came to check it out for themselves. They could talk to the swineherds. They could see, no doubt, the floating corpses of the swine. And they couldn't believe what met their eyes. More than that, there was Jesus, and next to him was the one that they had only known as an uncontrollable demoniac. No longer was he naked, raging, screaming, and cutting himself. Instead, he was sitting there clothed and in his right mind. Well, what was the response of the people to this sight? Did they rejoice? Did they praise Jesus? Did they ask him to do other blessings in their midst? No, their response was the same response the disciples had when Jesus stilled the storm. They were afraid. They were afraid. For the man who had been possessed, the presence of Jesus brought deliverance. For the others, it seems that Jesus' power over demons frightened them. More, perhaps, than they had been frightened by the mad demoniac. And they plead with Jesus to leave their region. Now, it's sometimes suggested that their motives were economic. Think of the financial loss of all the dead pigs. At least explicitly, that doesn't figure into the story at all. What we're really drawn to is the striking change that had come over the formerly demon-possessed man, and the power that must reside in Jesus to effect such a change. And in their fear, they would prefer not to have that power in their presence. What might he do next? And Jesus, in a sense, as he had done to the demons, accedes to their wishes. Verse 18, and when he got into the boat, he who had been demon-possessed begged him that he might be with him. So Jesus gets in the boat. He will leave the region. But this man who had been delivered now uses the language of discipleship. In asking that he might be with him, he uses the very same words that Jesus used back in chapter 3, verse 14. Then Jesus appointed 12 that they might be with him. This was the essence of discipleship. It was to be with Jesus. This man whom Jesus had liberated from possession by a legion of demons wants to join the 12 and become a disciple of Jesus. Watching him get into the boat as one adopted into the apostolic band would seem to be the perfect ending to the story. But that's not what happens. Verse 19, however, Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you. And he departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him, and all marveled. Interesting, isn't it? Jesus acceded to the wishes of the demons to go into the pigs, but he did not accede to the wishes of this man to follow him as one of his close disciples. But he does give him a commission, a very special commission. Jesus says to this man, go home to your friends and tell them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has had compassion on you. So this Gentile man is to remain in Gentile territory and bear testimony to his family and friends of the compassionate work of the Lord in his life. Can you imagine someone better qualified to have such a story for those who knew him. And he does fulfill this commission and more. The verb that's translated here, proclaim, he departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis. This is the word that's used throughout for preaching the gospel. Decapolis is Greek for 10 cities, so it's a reference to this entire Gentile region. And what we see is this man, who had been delivered from demons by Jesus, now goes out preaching everywhere in the region to his fellow Gentiles. And the content of his preaching is significant. Remember, Jesus had directed him to tell what great things the Lord had done for him. Now, when Jesus speaks in the third person of the Lord, it usually seemed to be a clear reference to God or to his Father. But what does this man preach? He departed and began to proclaim in Decapolis all that Jesus had done for him. It's a little thing, but do you catch that? Jesus says, go tell about the Lord. And he goes and he tells about Jesus. And Mark expects us to get the point. Jesus is Lord. This is one of the fundamental expressions of the gospel. The former demoniac goes forth throughout the Gentile region preaching Jesus is Lord. Probably not what you expected at the end of the story when it first began. Well, I want to reflect in a few ways on the significance of this story and what we can learn from it. First of all, we see that Jesus' authority over the demonic realm is powerfully demonstrated. We do not live in some equal dualistic world where some equal evil force is posed against some equal positive force and they're at war and no one knows how it's going to turn out. Now, it's very clear, Jesus has authoritative power over the demonic realm. The demoniac was strong. He was able to break chains used to bind him. The power of the strong man, Satan, was at work in him. But he was no match for the stronger one who had come to bind the strong man. In their plea that Jesus not torment them, the demons reveal a knowledge of Jesus' ultimate plan. For he will conquer Satan and all his demons, who will suffer eternal torment in the lake of fire. Revelation 20, verse 10. And here in this story, as Jesus' kingdom breaks into history, we are given a foretaste of this coming victory over Satan. As surely as he vanquished an army of demons, so surely will he conquer their commander and all their fellow soldiers on that last day. Can one man rout an entire army? This man can. Jesus is victor over Satan. And you need to remember that this same Jesus is your victor now. Greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. Whatever Satan seeks to cast at you, whatever demons even seek to cast out you, Jesus is stronger. Jesus is victorious. Now, Jesus will be victorious forever. Secondly, we see that Jesus is shown as the one who brings life from death. The demoniac living among the tombs was a picture of death. His situation was utterly hopeless. Others could not control or help him. He could not help himself. The only thing in his future seemed to be self-destruction. But what did Jesus do? He met him in the place of death and restored him to life. This man experienced, as it were, a spiritual resurrection. And it was this that he proclaimed as he preached Jesus as Lord. This is the gospel, from death to life by the power of Jesus. From spiritual death to spiritual life by the power of Jesus. And thirdly, we see here that Jesus begins his mission to the Gentiles. Thus far, Mark has only showed us Jesus ministering among the Jews. But on this brief trip to the Gentile shore of the Sea of Galilee, Jesus establishes a beachhead for a future invasion. As John the Baptizer prepared the way for Jesus among the Jews, this unnamed former demoniac goes forth preparing the way for Jesus among the Gentiles. Interestingly, this is the first man Jesus sent out on a ministry of proclamation. We haven't read him doing that with the disciples yet. See, back in Jewish territory, Jesus tells people who have experienced deliverance from disease or demons not to tell others about him. Now, why is it? Well, it's what we see throughout the Gospels. At this time, the Jews had very confused expectations about the Messiah. They thought their Messiah was going to be this great political deliverer. If they identified Jesus as the Messiah, they would want to make him king, as we're told elsewhere they did want to do. Jesus didn't want to openly reveal his true and full identity too quickly with them. But among the Gentiles, he didn't have to worry about this. And so he sends this man forth openly to proclaim what he has done for him. You see, the gospel is for more than the Jews. The kingdom of God that comes in the ministry of Jesus tears down the wall of partition between Jews and Gentiles, even as it tears down every wall of partition that cultures would seek to erect today to keep people apart, to keep people at odds. Those are broken down by Jesus. And that ministry of gospel proclamation to the non-Jews has carried on to our day. The announcement that Jesus is Lord that rang forth from the lips of that former demoniac in the Decapolis has reached the shores of the United States of America. It has reached your ears, and by God's grace, it has reached your heart. If you are a Christian, if you are here today as a Christian, your story is the story of the demoniac. You have moved from spiritual death to spiritual life by the power of Jesus, and only by the power of Jesus. This Jesus who vanquished a legion of demons by the Sea of Galilee 2,000 years ago continues to subdue Satan's forces as he builds his kingdom. Jesus was victor then. Jesus is victor now, and the final victory of Jesus is absolutely certain. That is a message that you can proclaim with joy and confidence as you identify with Jesus and his kingdom. And if you have never done so through faith in Jesus, then today can be the day of your salvation if you will place your faith in him and experience the wonder of the transformation of being moved from a place of spiritual death to spiritual life through God's grace to you in his Son, Jesus. Let us pray.